This is CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. As usual, my name is Kingsley Kipuri, and I'll be your host for the next hour. We've got quite an exciting show lined up. I'm joined in studio by Angolan activist, award-winning journalist and writer, Rafael Marques de Moraes. Rafael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm so glad that you've managed to find time to be with us. I know you have a very packed schedule.
It's always a pleasure to make time for friends.
For friends. I like that we've been elevated to the status of friendship. Rafael, you've been writing a lot about freedom of speech and expression and corruption in Angola. You've been quite a thorn in sort of the state side for a few years. And if I'm not wrong, you were in prison as recently as last week, or you were arrested as recently as last week.
I was briefly held. The police has developed a new language for arrests, which it calls nowadays when it involves politically sensitive individuals. Mm-hmm. The police says it has gathered the individuals.
Okay.
So not arrested them, but gathered.
Okay.
So I was briefly gathered by the police, to use the official term now, which is not imprisonment or arrest or detention, but gathering.
Okay. And when you claim arrest, they say, no, we didn't arrest him.
We briefly gathered him.
Okay. Okay. I mean, what is your current status with the state? Because if I'm not mistaken, you had the 2-year suspended sentence, and it seems. So are you a free man? What is exactly your sort of state in regards to the judicial system in Angola right now?
You posed a very important question, whether I'm a free man or not. And my answer is that I'm a free man, and I will always be a free man because it depends on my conscience to be free. The body is a shackle, and the government can imprison that body, and we can have limitations with our bodies due to health issues or others, but we cannot have limitations with the ideals we espouse, and how do we defend them? And so that's why I'm a free man. Whether the government wants to contain my body, wants to punish me or not, it's a business of the government. My business is to remain free because I believe in the work I do. I believe in the importance of me being a good citizen and upholding to the values enshrined in the Constitution, such as the rights to freedom of expression, human rights, freedom of press, and that's what I do. So I'm a free man for that. And no government, no political pressure, no police officer can gather my thoughts and my resolve to do what I think is right and constitutionally binding.
Your stance, your sort of confidence in what is right and in what is just is so, it's powerful, and I'm feeling it, and it's inspired a lot of people, I think, in Angola and around the world to also stand with you.
I grew up as a very shy young boy.
Okay.
A boy and a young man, to put it right.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, I'm still a very shy person. But I also believe that if I'm entitled to speak out by law, by my profession, then that's all I need to do. And then go home and be quiet with my family. Also, quite often we have an issue here across Africa, not just Angola, in which you see very intelligent people, very good people, very creative people, and you ask yourself, why do we always get very bad governments, very incompetent governments, thieves in power, when we have such wonderful people?
Yeah.
Because quite often, those who feel to have integrity, to be honest, shy away from pushing the boundaries to ensure that evil does not prevail over what we believe should be the common sense in terms of running a society, in terms of coexisting. Look at South Africa now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good example of how the political elite is basically running the country astray. All these problems, Marikana, Nkandla, and so forth. And then you come to South Africa, as Angolans, for instance, we said, how come now South Africa has load shedding? You know, that's a problem we have in Angola. And we always had, and we feel it normal. So normal that you cannot feel being middle class or having some privileges if you don't have a power generator and an underground water tank with at least 3,000 to 6,000 liters.
You just can't rely on permanent water and electricity.
No, because blackouts are permanent, are just a regular feature.
Mm.
And contrary to South Africa, where you have a schedule, in the capital, it just goes off and no one tells you anything.
Yeah.
But then you try to look up to other countries. And for years, we Angolans tried to look up to South Africa to say, this is how we must run our country, at least, or have a good example. So then you look across and then you just see bad examples of bad governments.
Yeah.
How do we change that? We're citizens and we have to ask these questions ourselves on a very daily basis. How do we change bad governments? How do we, with our knowledge as citizens, contribute to good governance? And that is not idealistic, you know. It's simply because individuals who are often incompetent are more ambitious in pursuing the capture of the state.
Yeah.
And individuals who are very intellectual, very honest, or just have skills to run things properly, once their proposals get dished. And I'm sure, for instance, yesterday I was at a dinner and with some academics, and they were talking about now South Africa trying to buy Russian nuclear power plants, and the Chinese also offering some kinds of services, when South Africa had internally the skills to make things better. But then you won't find these individuals holding discussions, you know, holding their foot to say, these are the skills we have, and this is how we can make things work better. And then you will let the politicians bring in the Russian nuclear plants or the Chinese, you know, plants, and then have to retrain people to use that kind of technology when you can actually find individuals in South Africa who have the skills and the drive to make, to bring, to come up with homemade solutions for the energy crisis. And in the region also, there is potential that could help. But we do not seem to be able to cross boundaries and elevate the capacities that exist within the region to make things work in favor of the peoples, you know. And I say that because for years there was this frontline states ideal in which peoples across the region contributed for some kind of ideals of freedom, of independence.
Yeah.
But nowadays, we cannot bring ourselves to think, how can we be a frontline again? But this time for job creation, for more business interactions within the region that could be a lifeline for the economies of the region.
I think that that coupling of economic progress and social justice progress is an interesting one, because I dare say that one of the reasons that perhaps the issues in Angola are not so widely discussed is that Angola's economy was doing, from an external perspective, very well for a long time, one of the top 10, you know, fastest growing economies in the world. So I think there's often an assumption that if the economy is doing well or seems to be doing well externally, then the people must be doing well.
And the economy was doing wonderful.
Yeah.
But for the foreigners and for the ruling elite, not for the majority of the people. Just to give you an example, the Portuguese, over 200,000 flocked to Angola between 2000, in the post-war reconstruction period from 2002 to 2014. Mm. And they were remitting over 200 million euros a year back to Portugal, from Angola to Portugal. So the second largest remittance Portugal received from abroad. Essentially what happened was the government came up with a policy of national reconstruction that excluded ordinary Angolans, brought in over 250,000 Chinese workers for the rebuilding of the country. On the political discourse that Angolans were too lazy, that Angolans did not have the skills, and therefore the Chinese would build things faster as well, and the government would provide for the people.
Yeah.
And there was an incentive there. And people believed that, okay, if we don't have to work and just wait for the housing and the goods this national reconstruction will bring, then we will sit and wait.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good. I just wait and progress just happens around me.
So basically, the government immobilized, you know, especially the youth bulge, in this sort of illusion that they didn't need to work. They didn't need to be useful. They just needed to sit and wait. And therefore, there was no critical mass in the country to question the very process of national reconstruction. And you cannot rebuild a country without engaging your own citizens. And then, so what happened then, for instance, the real estate boom in Angola, and we had apartments now selling for $10 million a piece, and it became the most expensive real estate market in the world to a certain extent, where ordinary houses without swimming pools were selling for $3 million. But this was all catering for the foreigners converging in Angola to provide services to the government at all levels. We had for several years up to last year, throughout the country, road signs in Mandarin to direct Chinese truck drivers. And one question I wrote in one article, I said, well, during the war, we didn't see Chinese truck drivers trying to take food to people and drivers risking their lives to ensure that the provisions would get to areas cut off by the war. So how come now,
all of a sudden,
when the country was able to make between 2004 to 2010, around that, in a period of 6 years, because of the oil boom, nearly half a trillion dollars. So when you look now at this staggering amount of money and you look at what has been rebuilt and how society now is at a crisis because once the oil prices fell to below 50, suddenly there was no money in Angola. And then the question is, where are the $500 billion? How did the government spend it? And on what that we did not make provisions?
Yeah.
Did not diversify the economy. So it's an important, a critical element. That's why in my work, I do not distance or detract from the issues of corruption, human rights, and social and economic justice, because they go hand in hand. And it's also because of the institutionalization of corruption in the country that government officials feel nowadays the need to repress more. And why? Because What always worked in Angola was a parallel system of the stick and carrot, as I call it. Corruption to entice people that they could fend for themselves without need for the state to regulate the economy and provide adequate salaries, and people could just use their positions in the public sector as private stalls to sell extra services to the public. And then the stick, which is the political violence to mete out justice to those who dare to challenge the status quo. And I will give you an example of how it can be so micromanaged in terms of political violence. Just recently, I went to fix my car in the mechanic. And there were two MPLA members at the mechanic. And they asked the mechanic, why was he servicing my car? Didn't he know that the day MPLA issues, the MPLA is the ruling party, the NC counterpart in Angola, the day they send the people to mow me down with the machine guns, the mechanic will also be collateral damage. But that's how they try to isolate those who are critical of the system, to the extent of even interfering in something as parochial as taking the car to the mechanic.
Do you ever get scared when you hear these threats and you live under surveillance? You've written that you know that you feel like, you know, under surveillance and there's threats of being gathered or actually imprisoned or being under the threat of violence. Do you ever get scared? Do you ever consider not doing this anymore?
It actually just heightens my resolve, because that proves that I'm doing the right work, I'm doing the right thing. And a government who cannot tolerate criticism is a government that does not deserve to be in power, period. Is a government that is not prepared to serve its own people. Because if it's prepared to serve its own people, it should expect and it should be able to respond and address the criticisms that come from society. Contrary to it, it's a government that must be booted.
Did you always have such a strong sense of social justice, or was there some particular turning point that maybe awoke you? Or I'm just curious, when did you feel like you've really, your eyes sort of opened up to what was going on around you?
I grew with a sense of fairness at home from my mother, who was a simple vendor, market vendor. And at some point, I remember the first time I reported on corruption for the state daily newspaper, Journal d'Angola, which to date is the only daily newspaper in the country. It was about a member of the MPLA parliament who also ran a terminal at the Angolan port, Luanda's port. And his main business actually was stealing the merchandise that arrived at his terminal and sell it in his own shops. And I did an investigation, actually with the help of the police commander at the time in the port. And I published the story. So he went to the newspaper. He sent his brother, who was a general, for us to deny the story.
A general in the army, in the police?
A general in the army. For us to deny the story. And we refused. And he punched my colleague, the photographer, because we even took photographs, pictures of the containers. He had diverted from the terminal to steal the goods and then return them empty. And at some point, he went personally to the newsroom, negotiated with the director of the newspaper. And then the director came and said, yes, we have to deny the story. And my editor at the time said, you know, facts are all right. So if the member of parliament wants to deny it, then he should write the denial himself. So he sat, and of course he could not write. And then someone had to help him. And I said, the newspaper does not belong to my family. It belongs to the state. If that's the state's will, fine, but I have nothing to do with the story. So I refused to be part of it. And a denial was issued. Then his director called me to offer me boxes of fish. And it was a time in 93, when the war had just escalated in the country and there was serious...
It was still under civil war at this time.
Yes, and famine and beer and crates of beer. And I'm a vegetarian. So he just added insult to injury by offering me fish.
He miscalculated his carrot in this situation. An actual carrot would have been more...
Exactly. He just added insult to injury. And I was very, very angry that someone who was doing so much damage to other business people would think that he could bribe a journalist with fish and beer. And it was just, to me, it was disgusting. And so I really, that's when I thought, I said, you know, if I have another opportunity to blast these guys, I will just do it. And fortunately, I have not strayed from that sort of commitment. Because, again, politicians are individuals like us. What makes them so powerful? Security apparatus? I always say in Angola, and politicians get very angry, I say, these police officers, some of them, well, most of them, are cousins, brothers, you know, uncles. Security forces, the same.
Yeah.
Military, the same.
Still regular people.
Regular people. So there was even an incident once I wrote about a police commander who, in a case of torture of a young female activist, and the way they just basically abused this woman and just commanders tortured her. And then I received a call from my mother saying, oh, you know, so-and-so, actually one of the commanders was of our relations. And I was unaware of it and said, no, he's a family man. He's a good man. So what happened? I said, well, this woman was very badly beaten up. Then I realized that the commander who was standing for him used his identity and he got the blame. But it just shows that the repressive apparatus is not distant from us. And we can influence on a daily basis the same way this individual was able to call my mother and say, you know, how come I'm a family man? I was also able to speak to his family. And just as I came here to South Africa, I traveled. Sitting next to me was the son of a police commander who requested to sit next to me. And he was talking about the father as well.
Okay.
And then I asked him, how do you feel to have your father being part of a system that brutally assaults young people for the right to, because they simply exercising their right to protest and throws them in jail and all this violence? How do you feel about it? And he said, I asked my father the same question. And my father said, look at Obama. Has he been able to close Guantanamo Bay? You know, and everyone loves Obama. And so no relation. But then you see that within society, a debate, even at family level, is taking place. And that's what is important to stimulate, you know. And I didn't feel this young man who was asking me all these questions as the son of a police commander. I saw him as a fellow citizen and someone who was interested to engage in dialogue with me, to even understand his own situation as the son of a police commander and what the police is doing nowadays in beating up. And the main reason why he also wanted to talk to me was because on August 8, when I was briefly held,
gathered.
Briefly gathered. mothers of 15 political prisoners took to the streets to call for the freedom of the children who were accused of plotting a coup against President Dos Santos while in a book club reading discussing strategies of nonviolence, nonviolent protest, and Gandhi, Martin Luther King. Mm. And so they were just coup plotters because they were trying to use their intellect to think of ways of addressing the current situation in Angola without being punching bags for the authorities. And I'm sure I will see again this young man and we will continue with this conversation. Mm. But again, it's not the idea that we need to replace the president who's been in power for 36 years and needs to go anyway. It's the idea that we need to change our mindset first and foremost, because dictators strive where the mentality, the public mindset allows for it. You know, because a dictator is one individual, regardless of the apparatus he can create. So if a society is not able to, you know, put one man in his place, then there is something fundamentally wrong with that society. And there is something structurally wrong with the Angolan society, you know, because, again, one of President Dos Santos' greatest achievements was to impart in the Angolan mindset that the idea that the state is a lottery, the country's resources are a lottery, and people don't need to work. People do not need to be study seriously.
Yeah.
They just need to get diplomas. And I give another example. In the past 10 years, over since 2002, basically in the past 10 years, there have been, the government has accredited over 40 higher education institutions, universities. Mm. In the same period of time, you might not count the same number of high schools created by the government. So you wonder then, how do people move from secondary to university without going, because in Angola, secondary and high school are different.
Okay. So secondary comes first and then high school?
And high school.
And then you, okay.
University. But anyway, basically what we're talking about is people jumping from primary school to university. So, of course, statistically, you can say now that Angola in the past 10 years has trained tens of thousands of people that have earned their degrees at university level. But we have a situation whereby economists don't know how to do simple math. Lawyers do not know how to write. And so, but these individuals will fit into the system, you know, because mediocrity has become a tool that is promoted. All you need to do is to be mediocre and have a membership card of the ruling party.
I'm glad that you brought this up, because I can imagine people look to you for direction and almost want to know what's the end game. What are we going for? And I assume the easy categories are sort of one is to push for reform within the ruling party. I suppose another one is to have them voted out and have somebody else in their place. But you sound like you're striving for something that's a lot more difficult. You're talking about social consciousness and people changing their mindsets. But how does one do that? I hear you that's what we should be aiming for, but how?
You know, take South Africa. no regime in Africa has been more competent in setting up an apparatus of repression and segregation than the apartheid regime.
Yeah.
You know, it was extremely methodical. You know, what you have, the Mobutus, the Bokassas, are just individuals who were very good at mass killings.
Yeah, it's brute force versus brute force. Structural.
Yes. Separate. Here you had structural.
Yeah.
And you had social conscience. And that's what kept South Africa together. And that's what is being lost, social consciousness in South Africa. It's possible to have it in Angola because, again, the end game is not the capture of the state.
By somebody else.
It's the liberation of the state.
Okay.
To be at the service of the people as a regulatory body. So if Empire goes tomorrow and comes UNITA or another party,
yeah,
and we maintain the same mentality that we don't need to work to have perks, we need to have membership card, then people will switch the membership cards from Empire to UNITA or to any other party,
yeah,
because we haven't changed our ways of dealing with one another. So for me, the most important, yes, President Dos Santos must go. Yes, Empire has been in power for 40 years, and it's time also to go. Yes, UNITA has been was a movement that took so many years in the bush,
yeah,
waging a civil war against the government, and a new generation has also to rise within UNITA to make it a meaningful opposition party or even a ruling party. But if we don't change our mindset, and I will give you an example.
Please.
In 2012, after the elections, the Empelia, the government of Empelia, distributed a Lexus 570 to each member of parliament as gifts. And it's quite regular. So each one of those cars cost over $130,000 in Angola. And over 250 of those cars were bought for the National Assembly. Besides other perks and BMWs as well. And I wrote about that. No member of the opposition refused to receive the car. And just the windshield of one of those cars costs $8,000.
Not one opposition party member returned it or declined it?
No. So it's the mindset. Of course, if he has not declined it, if he comes to power with that same mindset, he will say, well, okay, this time the only shift is that more of us will get the Lexus because we are in power, and lesser of those who were before in power will get it. And so the change is that we know the value of money. Angolans do not know the value of money. I've dealt with rich people in Angola who've plundered the state coffers to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars. And once in a while, I've engaged with such individuals and followed them around just to have a feeling of how they spend their money. I cry because it's not different. And these people call themselves business people, but it's not different the way 50 Cent in the US deals with his own money. The difference being that 50 Cent sings, didn't steal from anyone. And these individuals have gone to the public purses and have just taken whatever it was needed. And there's also two other important aspects that is quite important to address. And I try to do that through my work and my public interventions.
Yeah.
In Angola, there is no separation of powers. And there is no separation between what is public and what is private.
So the judiciary, the executive, it's all sort of meshed into one.
Yes. And one example, for instance, when we look at Angola, and just last year I criticized Miss Kosana Dlamini, who made a statement, gave an interview explaining that Angola had a legitimate government and had a constitution and had done everything by the books in a very democratic way. And then I explained that we have a unique constitution in the world. in which the president is neither elected by directly by the people or by parliament. That's where we have the problem. So all the powers are concentrated in the presidency. Mm. The president is also the head of the executive. But constitutionally, the executive branch is an auxiliary body of the president, does not have... in the past, constitutional law, it was a sovereign body, one of the four sovereign bodies. Nowadays, we just have three, the president, the judiciary, and the parliament.
Yeah.
The parliament does not have oversight of the government because the president is a sovereign body and therefore the parliament cannot oversee
a
sovereign body. And also, when we go to elections, it is the first name on the list of the winning party that automatically becomes president of the republic. Within the MPLA, only one person has the power to draw that list. Is the president.
The president who was the first on the list the last time.
Yes. So essentially, it's up to the president to appoint the president of the republic. That's it. And another critical aspect, and just talking about the constitution as well, and the elections, is that imagine if we have 20 parties running and the winning party has 10% of the votes. It has the mandate to run the country and the first name on the list becomes the president of the republic with all powers, without having to negotiate with anyone, because parliament does not have oversight of what the executive does.
So it's actually ultimate power.
It's absolute power. It's absolute power. And that is wrong and needs to be changed and needs to be challenged and needs to be talked about so there is an understanding, especially outside Angola, of what our constitution is made of and how you can have elections to ensure that there is no democracy.
MPLA is having its sort of elective process coming up soon. Do you see or do you foresee President Dos Santos staying on? Do you think there'll be some kind of succession plan, perhaps his son, perhaps somebody else?
This is my personal opinion.
Yeah.
I believe President Dos Santos has lost the opportunity to leave power nicely and retire quietly. The way President Dos Santos has captured the state resources and divided it between his family and his cronies, and the current waves of crimes that are being committed. We had a massacre of pilgrims just last April in the Central Highlands province of Wambo.
Yeah.
And it's reckoned that at least 1,000 pilgrims were massacred by the police. These issues will come to haunt him once he leaves the presidency.
Yeah.
And the president has no ability to negotiate with his own critics for a way out of power. And so his major problem won't be the opposition. It will be people within his own party who have felt estranged from this absolutism of power by the president and the fact also that the president has sidelined many of the MPLA veterans and intellectuals and critics and individuals. The critical mass of MPLA has been sidelined. And what has emerged now as the party apparatchiks, some are just street thugs, especially one named Bento Kangamba, who actually married the president's niece, who happens to be also the director of the president's office, deputy director of the president's office. Mm. So, and then in the past few years, the president has been surrounding himself with his relatives and his wife's relatives. And that does not bode well for him, because he has no way out of power. So my sense is the president will want to stay in power until he dies. And he will do anything so that once that happens, then it will no longer be his problem, and he will not have to worry about where to live in exile, or if he remains in Angola, if he will be arrested, if what will happen to him. And recently I wrote an open letter to the president, asking him to free the political prisoners, the young people who are being used as scapegoats for the failures of the economic situation, for the Mount Sumi massacre, and other issues. But also pointing out to the president that he must start engaging with his critics if he's to salvage even his family's assets in the country, or just a portion of it, because I cannot see a situation in Angola changing and the family keeping everything it has, because it's basically the country, and that won't be possible. But he can mitigate the situation, and he can ensure that his children can stay in the country and have a future there and work with others. If he takes the resolution of surrendering power in a transitional manner. And he can only do that if he speaks to those he sought over these years to destroy.
So even from a self-interested perspective, it's actually in his best interest to actually start engaging, is what it sounds like.
It is in his best interest because, you know, one thing I always say, and I remember, for instance, for years, I was a critic of the Portuguese intervention in Angola, and I called Portugal a laundromat for Angola's money laundering schemes. And people were very angry at me, and I was even banned in some Portuguese media. And one quite well-known TV anchor had his contract was not renovated for inviting me to his Newsnight programs. His name is Mario Crespo, and he has a long history with South Africa. He worked here for many years for SABC. And I always said, Angola depends on oil. 96%, at least, between 95 and 96% of our foreign currency external revenues come from oil. Any change in the oil price deeply affects the Angolan economy, either for a boom or for a bust. And now we're in the bust period. And years also of mismanagement, misrule, and having all these Portuguese companies, Portuguese individuals, basically feverishly finding ways of grabbing whatever they could from the state, the Angolan state, led to a situation whereby now, within a year, we have droves of Portuguese leaving, companies collapsing for investments they made in Angola, for investments in Portugal, for their relations with Angola, corruption scandals breaking up all the time, breaking out all the time, and a very, very difficult situation for Portugal now because of the crisis in Angola. And for years, I have been seeing that. I said, no,
this is going to happen.
This is going to happen because it's not sustainable. You know, when Portugal, for instance, had the conditions to help, you know, mitigate the plunder of Angola and to say, we must find ways of making the Angolan economy sustainable and help diversify it. No, but the first idea was, let's get as much as we can. And that has not improved the situation in Portugal. One of the leading, most venerable institutions in Portugal, private institutions, Banco Espírito Santo, collapsed at the weight of Angolan corruption, with the weight of the Angolan corruption. $7 billion disappeared from its branch in Angola, and the bank collapsed. And now there are several people under investigation, and the former chairman of the bank now under house arrest, who happened to be the political kingmaker of Portuguese politics. So even with South Africa, business relations have always been extremely difficult. for the inability of South Africans to understand the Angolan mindset, and also for some resistance in going the extra mile in the corruption schemes for business to thrive in the country.
I mean, you mentioned the oil price. So, I mean, a lot of Angolan oil exports was going to the United States of America, and that's since declined with a move away from crude oil.
Now it's to China. Half of our oil
is now to China. So I think one might hope, and maybe this is a stretch, is that with the change in the oil prices and the reduced so our foreign currency coming into the Angolan state, that perhaps that might weaken the government's ability to be oppressive.
Take the carrot away. Because the government only knows how to deal with the carrot,
the stick. Yeah.
If you take the carrot away, then they think they can use both hands to use the stick.
Yeah.
That's when they become more repressive.
Yeah.
Just this morning, I was reading a statement made by the Minister of Information against basically, and there was a mention that was clearly directed at me, and saying that good journalists are those who serve the government. This is a straightforward statement, and journalists have to be patriotic. And criticizing, and now he talks about an anti-Angolan campaign. So that's when these individuals even go back to the old days of Marxism-Leninism to try to find, rationalize how they've run the country to the ground and how, with all the potential they had, with all the control the government has been able to master of the media landscape, now they're being beaten in the internet, in the social media.
Yeah.
And each time someone from the ruling party makes a comment in defense of the regime on the social media, will attract 10 more negative comments. So the social media has become the last frontier for freedom of press and freedom of expression in the country. And the government has lost that war. In 2011, actually, the president tried to pass a law.
Yeah.
Submitted a law to the National Assembly where his party holds 72% of the seats, in which it would criminalize sending an email mentioning the name of a third party without the written consent of that third party, which meant if the state security that has access to my emails saw me writing about President Dos Santos,
they can ask you, do you have his written consent? And if you don't...
Yes, then I could be prosecuted for that. And so the jail sentences for internet offenses went as... could go up to 12 years in terms of prison sentence.
Mm.
When in fact for pedophilia, you know, in the country could just go as low as 8 years. So it's the obsession of micromanaging the way people think, the way people act, and the way people must be responsive to mediocrity, to incompetence, you know, to thievery. That's what I cannot stand, you know, because... how are we going to realize our potentials? How are we going to ensure that those who are talented? Yesterday I went to just to drop some footage at a production company refinery. And I looked at the infrastructure and I said, but why can't we have this in Angola? And the reason why I was speaking about it is because there was a poster of a movie that was shot here in South Africa, in which one of the leading actors is an Angolan who happened to play theater with me.
Okay.
And then I said, you know, this is a good example. This guy played theater with me, is able now to
transition and be on the billboard.
Yes, for a movie now that is being screened in international festivals. So we have potential. And then my friend said, well, but you don't have skills to run a company like this back home. I said, but this actor is skilled in what he does. And when we did theater, we were creating the skills for production.
The audiences, so the market is there. So it's the ingredients.
And then
there.
I gave the example of a young, the brother of one of the actors who played in the same company with me in Elinga Teatro. There was, we had a piano. Someone had left a piano there in the place where we rehearsed. And this young kid who came from the slum and he used just to go and watch us rehearse.
Okay.
Listen to someone play on the piano for Elise. And within days, he was playing it.
Wow.
And he didn't know any musical notes. He
couldn't read. He didn't know the
technicalities
behind it.
He just saw this woman playing once, just for fun. And he learned it, and he played it beautifully. You know. And I gave many other examples. Of course, we are not born dumb. You know, we can evolve, and that's what we are at. It's one of the critical elements in many countries.
Yeah.
Take Nigeria. You have Nigerians excelling everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
In South Africa as well. You know, South Africans. Why can't we bring back all these skills and make our countries work for ourselves? Why do we always need, like in the case of Angola, everyone said, oh, Angola is growing. And as a kid, I have always known Angola as a country where foreigners came to run everything.
So that was just the norm.
Right after independence, the Cubans came and the Russians came to run everything. Even bakeries, we had Cuban advisors in bakeries.
To run a bakery.
Yes. Then the Cubans left. Then came the humanitarian period of Angola, in which we had scores of Americans, Frenchmen, whatever you call the NGO sector, training us on 2 weeks democracy courses and food aid and so forth. And then once this humanitarian period was phased out after the war, then came the Chinese and the Portuguese who flocked back. And many of them behaved as if it was just a continuum of the colonial period. And then I ask myself, I've studied, I have skills, you know. I went to university at a later stage. I had to work first to save money to go to university. And I went to one of the best universities in the world.
Yeah.
And I was already an adult. And then I said, of course, if I can do it, many others can do it, you know. So why don't we realize this potential?
I mean, you mentioned this idea of social consciousness and getting young people to realize the potential they have, and not get sucked into this idea that one can benefit and then progress without actually working for it. Do you ever consider, or are you ever tempted to go into politics and influence things from that side? Do you ever picture the progress you could create and the consciousness you could create if you had the kind of power that the state does?
You've touched a very interesting question. Why do we all need to be politicians? That's the first question.
Mm-hmm.
And when we see some of the developed countries, their histories, some of the most influential people that have really left their imprints in the development of these countries were not politicians. You don't need to be a politician to influence the course of your country. You need to be an engaged citizen, whether in business, in civil society, in academia, as a thinker.
Yeah.
When we look at, for instance, some people might think that Gandhi was president of India. Gandhi was never president of India. he didn't join politics. He was always, actually, when I watched Gandhi's movie, there is a comment someone made, said, you know, it's more expensive to keep Gandhi poor. And that if he just decided to live a normal life, but the way he decided to be very humble was actually more costly for the party backing him. Some along those lines, we have in the U.S. Martin Luther King.
Yeah,
he was a religious leader, and he marked the history of the United States. He did not need to go to politics to do that. We have scientists, academics that have been extremely influential, you know, in shaping transitions, changes in the countries. We had in Russia, Solzhenitsyn, Sakharov. They were not politicians, you know. So why do we always have to think that in Africa, for you to do anything meaningful, you need to be a politician? That's what destroys, you know, our intellect. That's what destroys us. And that's what enables individuals who are extremely greedy, ambitious, and mediocre to capture the political space and then decide what the rest must do. Because we do not carve out strong islands, as I would call, of human resources that are able to affect politics in the countries. You have great universities here. But how strong is the academic academics here in shaping up and influencing policy changes and decision making? That's the question we have to ask ourselves. They don't need to shift from academia to politics. They need to be strong in what they do because they're part of society. They're part of the state. Singers in South Africa had a tradition. Miriam Makeba,
Yvonne Chaka Chaka,
Hugh Masakela, Yvonne Chaka Chaka.
Yeah.
They were great freedom fighters for singing and elevating the message of freedom. You know, just days ago I was passing, just as I was coming here, I saw the sign of, what was that? Clegg, Johnny Clegg.
Yes, yes.
And Savuka. You know, you could feel the South African struggle through the music, you know. And take Biko. His ideas remain central to the South African history of fighting apartheid.
Mm.
Did he have any political position? No, but he was able to share his ideas. And one might criticize, one might disagree or whatsoever, but he was influential. Mm. He was instrumental. And is to this date. That's what we need to think, that we don't need to be politicians, to be good citizens, and to impart our contributions for a better society simply because we're not politicians. And in Angola, what the government tries to do is exactly to tell people, if you're a politician, you're bad. Then if you're in civil society, they said you must become a politician. So when you become a politician, then you say, you see, you only want power. You want what we have as ours, which is as if they're the only ones who are entitled to dominate the political space. Yeah. I can't challenge them from civil society as a journalist. And yes, and here also it brings one question. People quite often say, how can you be an activist and a journalist? And then I say, I work from my kitchen table because I'm not allowed to have a space beyond that. Or resources beyond that.
Yeah.
So, and even out of my kitchen table, I'm always under constant threat. Recently, the head of the military intelligence, one of the heads of the military intelligence, instructed the police to raid my house to try to find documents whatsoever. Fortunately, the news came out before there was a leak. Mm. And the operation has not materialized so far. So I have to fight for the right to be a journalist. And it makes me an activist. Does it conflict with my profession? No, it does not conflict, because I don't live in a normal society whereby I can just do my job the way I should do. I have to fight first and foremost for the space to do it.
I hear you. I hear you. I'm curious about Maka Angola. This the organization that you run focuses a lot on corruption and exposing what's really going on in the country, and I can't help but think, where do you get the material and the information from in a country where it's the stakes are very high to be seen as anti-MPLA, to be seen as anti-government, but yet you constantly have information on money transfer, on ownership deals, on, and what is this network that seems to be feeding this information on what's really going on? How are you able to still make that happen?
I will give you an example. Yeah. In 99, when I was in jail, then I was transferred to after 11 days in solitary.
This is the
first time I spent time in jail.
Okay.
I was transferred to, after 11 days in solitary confinement, I was transferred to a normal prison. Mm-hmm. In the normal prison, someone came, a prisoner, with a file and said, this is all the documents pertaining corruption in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So I had a file. So when I left jail...
A fellow prisoner just comes to you and hands you...
And when I left jail, not only I left with those documents, but I also left with basically important records from the jail itself. And I was under surveillance in jail as well. One individual who had actually shot, and this is how I had to organize my mind, who was in jail for having shot an 8-month pregnant woman. He came to me and said, from now on, I'll be your bodyguard here because you're under threat here. And then next to me, sleeping next to me, was a member of a police death squad who was hiding in jail. And he would spend his day around out of jail, and then he would just come and sleep in jail to hide, because someone higher up wanted to get rid of members of that particular death squad who had been instructed to execute a number of individuals involved in some funny business. And this included the nephew of a senior police officer. So this individual told me all the stories about how the death squads operated in Angola and who ran them and everything. So when I left jail, one member of parliament said, we've given the gold to the bandit. That's social consciousness. You can actually, by leading by example, even within the most corrupt echelons of the power, you will find people who will come to you and say, I have a conscience. And this is my contribution to the cause. And that's why they wanted to raid my house, believing that I would have anything in my house. I'm not that stupid. I don't have anything in the house. So, and then actually I received a call from a senior officer from the police. And I said, you can come anytime. you can come and get whatever you
open
want.
Open the door, let them in, go ahead.
Yes, you won't find what you're looking for. Because if this very same commander, head of military intelligence, when he gave the instructions, the fact that the information came out was sign enough that I didn't need documents. That whatever he was doing, he was not the one watching me. I was the one watching him. Then again, that's the influence one can have in a society in a very meaningful way. And you don't need to be a politician to do that. You need to be a good citizen, have a very good understanding of society. At some point in my life, I dropped everything and I went to study anthropology to understand, you know, the social mindset of Angolans. So I haven't used it for academic purposes, but I'm using it for more what I think are more relevant purposes, to try to engage better with all sectors of society and find ways of saying this is not a struggle against the MPLA or the president. It's a struggle for us to change for the better, because we need to give direction to this society. After 41 years of war for independence and civil war, after 10 years of squandering the resources of the country in the post-war reconstruction, Angolans need a better chance at the future. And as an Angolan, you know, it is my duty as well, and it's my privilege to say we can take this way or that way. And for that, I don't need to be a politician. I need to be an opinion maker. I need to be someone who knows how to address issues and where the information is, because information is key to educate society.
I mean, you mentioned... You just mentioned education as a big part of what your role is. I'm curious as to how widely known some of what's going on is acknowledged around the country. So, for example, you mentioned the Mount Sumi massacre, where you mentioned there were pilgrims and sort of government forces went through and killed up to 1,000 people at a religious gathering. Is that known to people in Angola, in Luanda, and around the country? Do people know that happened?
It is very well known, okay. And the government has cordoned off the area where the massacre took place, so the journalists cannot interact. As soon as the massacre happened, I was able to interview members of the military, members of the police who were involved in the massacres, as well as witnesses and the survivors. And I wrote even for a piece for The Guardian in England. Also, what I had was someone who actually was at Mount Sumi to come to me in the capital to speak to me directly. And that shows, and as I was speaking on the phone, some people would say, but your phone is tapped. I said, yes, let them listen and know how carefully researched is this? Because how many more of you will they kill to prevent sources coming to me? Do not be afraid. Let them listen. And it's good that they listen, because it affects them as well. And some of these people listening as well are human beings, are individuals. Yeah. They have feelings.
They're hearing what's being said.
And they're learning. And one day it will affect their judgment and the way they are so loyal to the system. And sometimes I have fun encounters with or run-ins with my friends at the police and the state security apparatus. Just days ago, as I was driving, a police officer stopped me. And when he looked at me and my name, he said, "Oh, for quite some time, I've made a promise that I would stop you in traffic." And then so he went on and on and on and on. And he called his boss. I said, "Didn't I tell you I would stop this guy?" And I was just looking at him like, what's going on? Then he said, that book you wrote on diamonds that landed you in court. Oh, man. I've been searching for that book. And I said, I have a spare copy here in the car. I can give it to you. He said, you're joking. I said, no, I can't give it to you. And then I gave him the book and he said, no, you must sign. And then, interestingly enough, as I was signing, he said, so sign to Sergeant whatever. He proudly wanted to have the book autographed.
And signed to him.
To him. And give me your phone number. And then he called back the boss and said, I got a book from him. This is to say that even when, and in my own history of being harassed by the police all the time, I also find the time to collect good stories of interactions with police officers. And I will just tell you one thing, which is out of a movie. In 1999, when I was in jail, at some point, I got sick, and then I had to be taken to a private clinic because the prison services did not want to provide me with the medical service. They said, no, we will give you a guard since you are a high-profile prisoner, and a nurse to accompany you to a private hospital clinic. So off we went. And then as we finished with the private clinic, the nurse said, we must go to your house and you must rest a little bit. And we know your house is close to the private clinic. So I said, okay. So we went to the house and I went and actually I slept. You know, it felt good to
be in your own bed.
So when I woke up, the police officer was completely drunk and asleep, and the gun was on the other side and he on the other side. Now, the problem was for me to take the police officer to the car and then take his gun. And so while I was sleeping, basically they raided my fridge and got all the alcohol that was there. And then, okay, finally I managed to hide the gun so that the neighbors would not see me, the prisoner, carrying the gun, and the police completely wasted. And, you know, this is the... So I managed to get him in the car and then put the gun on the side. And then I thought, is this some kind of devious plot in which then... he uses the gun and said that I got him drunk.
It sounds like a trick. It sounds like a trap, man.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. And do I keep the gun next to him? Do I keep the gun with me? Oh, boy. And then the nurse, who was still half conscious, said, no. I made you a favor. Now you need to do me a favor. We need to go and visit my girlfriend. So then we drove off to the girlfriend.
Okay.
And then he, as I was waiting in the car with the police gun and the police wasted, he comes with the whole family and the neighbors to introduce the famous prisoner. And the girlfriend was pregnant, 6-7 months pregnant. And then he asked me to be the godfather of his girlfriend, of his child.
Did you agree?
I just looked at him. I said, look, can we go back to jail?
Can we discuss this another time?
You know, I need to go back to jail. I said, no. Because I was getting very nervous.
What is happening?
And I said, you know, what trick is this? And then they come and they start talking about business.
Jesus.
And the in-laws come and people then start coming out to see me in the car.
Oh, Jesus.
And then the police is wasted. It's gone. And I said, how are we going to get to jail? With the police who cannot hold his gun. Anyway, so in the end, as I put it, you get to a point where you just think, one day when I tell my grandchildren these stories, they will not believe me. They will say, oh, grandfather exaggerates. You're such a raconteur. You know, you make up stories and you're a funny man. And then that's when you think, okay, society has normalized, and my grandchildren cannot believe the things I had to go through.
And the godson that you have somewhere.
And then when they take things for granted, then you say, I've done my bidding. So that this story is just anecdotal. Actually, it didn't happen. And then you're happy that you don't have to, you know. And if you write about it, then it's just pure fiction. Because you cannot make it up. It's just... And then there was a police officer who was in charge of basically harassing me every day in jail. And then he became my secret photographer to take pictures of the prisoners and the others who had some serious problems.
Yeah.
There are many ways you can deal with it. Many ways. And the main issue here is not to be bitter and to think those are the ones stealing, doing bad. We must remove them and lock them up or... send them into exile, but just understand they're brothers and sisters. How do we address this so that it doesn't happen again? And we can then find that common path, you know, so that even their grandchildren, when they say, you know, your grandfather stole $10 billion, they said, no, that's not possible. You know, you're making up this story. Mm. And then you say, okay, this child is also normal now. Because now, there is a whole generation that believes they're entitled to plunder the country. There is an expression in Angola among the children of the elite, "O meu pai rouba feio, a minha mãe rouba feio," meaning my father or my mother steals galore as a badge of honor. And when I talk about social consciousness, I'm talking about very simple things as making these young people understand that stealing galore is not a badge of honor. It is a crime and must be dealt with as a crime. And there's nothing to be honored about committing such crimes that deprive the majority of the people of access to basic services.
I mean, you've mentioned young people a lot as we've spoken and their mindsets to what's going on. Do you think there may be a turning point coming soon with the likes of the 15 young people who are meeting and discussing sort of political consciousness? Do you think it's possible that perhaps there's another younger generation of activists that are becoming more aware and more willing to get stuck into this conversation, not only on social media, but on the streets?
Angola is undergoing right now a turning point. What we need to assess is whether the tipping point, if I might, English is not my first language, so, but I like to make a difference between the turning point and the tipping point.
Okay.
Turning point because things will not be the same. There is change in the way. Change because the economy has been affected. And the economy was the trump card of the government because it could use it to buy international legitimacy and also tell people, you wait for your turn. Without the economic discourse of success, the government has very little to bargain with the rest of society. The tipping point, what is it going to make change tomorrow or after or within 10 years? That's what we don't know yet and have to figure out. So this is a turning point, but what's the tipping point that make things that change that we dream of in a very scared way, and sometimes we also think of it as a nightmare? And in a country where the president has been in power for 36 years, you still have people believing, so like, but if he goes, who's going to rule us? And you also might have the same mindset in Mugabe, but yeah, Mugabe goes, but who's going to rule us? The Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah.
And that's where we have to invest more to make people understand. Because what these leaders are good at is at making themselves irreplaceable and creating in society the idea that no one else can do what they do. Whether they do it right or wrong, they're the ones who must do it. And quite often you also hear from diplomats and members of the international community saying, well, the president of Angola is the factor of stability. Mm. What stability when his police is beating up the mothers of protesters? When he's plundering, bleeding the country dry? What stability? So that's why by exposing corruption, by exposing human rights abuses, by making the linkage between the current, the economic situation, the inequalities in the country, we're able to expand the conversation and somehow reduce the levels of public relations that have foreign governments, multinationals with high interests in Angola, protecting the status quo. And that has been the difference, let's say, with Zimbabwe. Once Mugabe berated Tony Blair, the British press went after him in ways that at some point became counterproductive. In the case of Angola, for many years, you had the whole international community singing praise for the regime, and the regime could essentially act with impunity and international legitimacy for that impunity. And that impunity can only be stripped, you know, by stripping the ability of the regime to use the economy to essentially please foreign audiences in detriment of the well-being of the Angolan people.
I mean, you've mentioned this idea of solidarity, I think not only in Africa, but amongst journalists and other sort of fellow activists. Are you seeing enough of that on the continent and with South African media and journalists and continental ones? Or do you think there's still some more that we can do in standing together?
Unfortunately, and here we have to be truthful, there is very little solidarity among African journalists, among civil societies in Africa. And quite often that solidarity has to go through international Western organizations.
Channeled.
And one example was the case of Thulani Maseko and Becky Mahubu in Swaziland. The greatest pressure came from Western organizations. Mm. My own trial, the greatest pressure came from Western organizations. I had a friend, a South African journalist, trying to push the South African media to cover more Angola, but that was quite difficult. And sometimes you just find out of personal interest, I think a year or two ago, I did a major article on the persecution of Islam in Angola. And there is a radio here in Johannesburg which called me Islam, I think it's basically dedicated to Islamic issues. Okay. So they called me to talk about that. But then, out of own volition of the journalists, each time they realized there was a problem in Angola, they would call me. And so it just became a regular feature. Yeah. During my trial, they also called me and said, you know, hey, brother, how are things going? Mm. So I think it's more important for solidarity to be also for us to have the ownership and initiative of having more solidarity between one another, you know. Like, for instance, the Western media will often call me and say, can you write a piece on this or on that? And I will do it. Mm. do I get calls, for instance, for African media outlets to say, you know, can you write a piece? And not that the Western media will pay me for what I write, but the African brothers will not call me for that. So we need to change that. And again, quite often we think we need to be politicians. There's always great solidarity among politicians.
Oh, yeah.
Do we need to be politicians as well as journalists to interact more between us? Of course not.
I mean, I hear you, and I really, you know, I really think it's something we need to push for. And you, thankfully, your sort of time here this week, yes, I hope, has started fostering those conversations. I'm curious to your analysis, sort of back to this political situation in Angola right now, of sort of analyzing the trends and seeing what you're calling a turning point and seeing all the elements coming together, not only the oil price, not only Dos Santos' time in power, not only things like the Monsumi massacre. And when you look at it all together, what if you had to speculate on what things are going to look like in the next 10 years, where do you see this going?
In the next, I wouldn't speculate on the next 10 years, okay, but let's say in the next 10 years, 20 years.
20, okay.
We will see an Angola as a driving force in Southern Africa. Driving economic force, driving social force, driving political force, for one main reason. At this point in time, the majority of Angolans can stand for as a clean slate. We have a very young population, very eager to learn, and once they're provided with good schooling, there will be a major force to reckon with. And also, Angolans will not be shy about making decisions in the region, which South Africa has been shying away. And also, there's something I discuss with my South African friends who say, well, you know, we have all these skills, but we lack some socialization skills. And I said, Angolans have plenty of that and can teach South Africans how to dance kizomba and have more fun. So relax a little bit more and be more socially interactive and have great fun. That is possible. And when I say driving force, the idea of regional powers must be cast aside.
Yeah.
We don't need regional powers. What we need is driving forces for us to move together, because we need to move together, you know. Many industries in South Africa are somehow not able to generate more jobs because of exports. Angola needs lots of exports, imports a lot. We need factories. We need to industrialize the country. Yeah. And South Africa can play a major role in that. But for that, we need to root out corruption as the institutional mechanism to do business in the country, you see. That's why you cannot detract from these issues if you want to move forward. And so there is no need for competition between South Africa and Angola, but partnership so that the countries with lesser resources can also benefit, because for you to take goods from South Africa to Angola and vice versa, you have to cross Namibia, for instance.
Yeah.
And just the cooperation between the two countries stands to benefit also a third country. Yeah. And more countries can benefit from that. And again, I have this focus on economics, on economy, because that's what creates jobs. There is a large population in South Africa that is disenfranchised because they have no jobs. Or then are paid wages that just put bread on their plates and very little else. But if there is a strong economic partnership, then we can be the driving forces. And then you have Congo with huge potential do we have to let the West, China, and others always come and say, well, you know, we're here to help you and we will take as much as we can and leave very little because you don't know what you're doing with your resources and you're not able to get your acts together. No, we can do it. But we need to be strong. We need to be very open-minded. And we need to criticize what is wrong, regardless whether it's President Zuma or President Dos Santos or whoever, so they can see the light. And also, they can see that great progress for the majority of people means they can even have more money in their pockets and live without, you know, the fear of being persecuted for this or for that.
Or not being able to leave office because...
Exactly, exactly. Like Mr. Dos Santos now is trapped in the office of the presidency. He's trapped there. And then he... It's like when we watch those movies, bad movies, in which a guy says, okay, I'm surrounded. Now I will just booby trap the place around me for the last stand. That needs to change. The other important aspect as well, for instance, there is very little cultural interaction in the region. South Africa knows very little about Angola literature, music, and so forth, and vice versa, and Zambia and others. We need to find ways of connecting the academias of these countries, the music industry and other industries, so the interactions are not dependent upon the bilateral relations between the governments. And that's, again, where it is completely wrong, because we think everything must be done by politicians, and we surrender our freedoms, our lives to the politicians. Not because the politicians want to take all that responsibility. It's just because we're too lazy to.
Surrender.
That's basically.
Rafael, thank you so much for being a beacon of what it means to stand up for what is truthful and what is just. And thank you for making time for this interview.
Thank you very much, Kingsley. And thank you for those listening. And I hope, you know, the idea of social consciousness rings a bell, and that you can all share and discuss it and see then how we can talk more about this, because we need desperately that social consciousness back.
Fantastic. Thank you for listening to the Daily Maverick Show. You know where to find us on cliffcentral.com. Remember, you can download the podcast or listen live every Tuesday from 1 to 2 p.m. Thank you.
This is cliffcentral.com.